Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. By the end of the day today, President Trump will likely become the fourth American president to have articles of impeachment voted against him by a congressional committee. There was heated debate this morning as members of the House Judiciary Committee debated the details of allegations that the president abused his power in pressing Ukraine to investigate a political rival and obstructed Congress in their attempts to investigate those accusations. Washington State Democrat Pramila Jayapal pushed back at Republicans with this question.
Is any one of my colleagues willing to say that it is ever okay for a president of the United States of America to invite foreign interference in our elections? Not a single one of you has said that so far.
I'll say.
I yield to my colleague from Texas.
Will the gentlelady yield so we can answer the question?
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be glad to answer.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us with the latest. And Kelsey, wading through all of the back and forth, take us through the process we're seeing right now.
Well, what we are seeing today is called a markup. And a markup is basically congressional speak for a chance for a committee to leave its mark or change something before it goes to the floor for a House vote. Now, we are not really actually expecting much to change about these articles of impeachment, though Republicans are really trying right now. They're offering amendments. The one we just saw that took 2 hours to debate was an attempt by Jim Jordan of Ohio to strike the first article of impeachment, the abuse of power portion, and just remove it from the proceedings altogether. It was voted down along party lines, but it was heated and it took hours for them to get through all of the fighting about this. That's because there are more than 40 members on this committee and they are all fighting for their chance to be heard.
Yeah, and we've been hearing a lot of those impassioned speeches. Late last night, freshman Democrat Lucy McBath of Georgia declared her support for articles of impeachment in a statement referencing her son's shooting death in an argument over loud music. Let's listen.
This is not why I came to Washington. I came to Washington because I love my country. I came to Washington full of hope, empowered by my community to serve them in Congress. And it is an honor to carry out this work every single day to make sure that no one else goes through the same pain that I have.
Kelsey, McBath is considered to be a vulnerable freshman lawmaker. How is her decision and really those other Democrats, vulnerable Democrats, being viewed?
Well, McBath is an interesting case here because she, while she is technically vulnerable, she is on the Judiciary Committee. And it was expected that she would get on board here. And that's actually the expectation of a lot of the moderates. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, was asked about this today in her press conference, about what she was telling moderates about whether or not they should vote for impeachment. And she said that she has no message for them and she is not whipping, which means she's not going and trying to convince any members to vote one way or another. She said that people need to come to their own conclusions. And they've seen the facts as presented, and they need to do what they think is right to defend their oath that they made to protect and defend the Constitution.
Yeah. So based on these speeches that we're hearing, it seems that everyone's going along party lines. But do you expect any defections from Democrats? And how many, if so, are even likely?
Well, we could see a handful of defections. We don't know exactly who. People are keeping their cards pretty close to the vest right now. But as I've talked to staff and to members up here, they said they wouldn't be surprised if there were maybe 3, 4, even 5 Democrats who voted against impeachment. We don't really see Republicans crossing over. We might see the independent, Justin Amash of Michigan, voting for impeachment. But largely, this is expected to be split down party lines.
Yeah, and in talking about the Republicans, Matt Gaetz of Florida said the GOP has an unwavering support in defense of Donald Trump. Let's take a listen.
Both President Trump and President Zelensky said there was no pressure. We saw the call transcript, and there's no conditionality. There was never awareness on the part of the Ukraine that there was a delay in aid, and the Ukraine got the aid without opening the investigation that seems to be so troubling to Democrats.
With the little time I have with you, Mitch McConnell has said he's not sure if there will be witnesses called once this moves to the Senate. What more can you tell us about the possibility of what that will look like?
Well, McConnell is currently working with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to work out the rules here. But there's a lot of feeling among Republicans that having witnesses and people come in and testify could turn the Senate trial into a long circus. And that's something they're trying to avoid.
Yeah. Kelsey Snell is NPR congressional correspondent. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
British voters are going to the polls today. Yep, we know you've heard that before. This is the third general election in less than 5 years in the United Kingdom. The results will determine which party controls Parliament, who will be Prime Minister, and what happens with Brexit, the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union. Voters said yes to Brexit in 2016, but the government hasn't cut the cord so far. NPR's Frank Langford is in London. And Frank, why are Britons going to the polls yet again?
Well, the reason they are, Lisa, is Boris Johnson, the prime minister, does not have enough votes to get his Brexit withdrawal agreement through the parliament. If you remember, his predecessor, Theresa May, tried to get her deal through. It failed three times. And so basically, he's at a stalemate. He can't move forward. And so his solution is to hold an election and try to win as many seats as possible so he can get this thing done.
So does it look like, I mean, it sounds like he's very much in a hard place right now. Is he in trouble in his position as prime minister?
I don't think so. I think it's impossible to predict these elections. A number of the recent elections that we've had have all been a bit of a surprise. His party, though, is a good 9-10 points up in the average of polls. And so the expectation is that he could win a small majority. But we could also end up with a hung parliament in which it's very hard to poll with all of these seats around the country. So you could end up with a hung parliament where we're sort of stuck back in the same place that we have been really now for, gosh, over 2 years.
And Frank, you've been speaking with voters. What are you hearing now?
Well, I think one thing is Boris Johnson's message, which is get Brexit done, has been very effective. It has cut through a lot of the, you know, it's cut through a lot of the political noise. And you would find a lot of Brexit voters very supportive of this. They're just tired of it. But also you'll find people who didn't vote for Brexit who just are suffering from fatigue and they feel like the country, even if this is a mistake economically and it's going to hurt the country, they would like the country to move on. It's been interesting to talk to Labour voters. There are a lot of them who really like Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, particularly some of his socialist policies, his focus on income inequality. But I was talking last night around Oxford Circus in central London to a fellow named Simeon Blake Hall. He's an actor. He's 25 years old. And he was saying he likes Corbyn a lot, but he's concerned that Corbyn doesn't really have the political cunning to take on someone like Johnson, who is a very challenging politician. And in many cases, people here feel often Johnson says things that are not true. This is what Simeon Blake Hall said yesterday.
We have this prime minister right now who is able to just lie so brazenly and just get away with it. There's so many open goals, I feel, that Corbyn's missed.
Who do you think is going to win?
Boris.
So he thinks that Boris Johnson, the Conservative prime minister, is going to win, the man who's trying to get Brexit done. Are Conservative voters equally confident?
They're not. I think that there's anxiety. They were higher up in the polls earlier. They seem to have more momentum. But Boris Johnson has been out and he's been making some mistakes on the campaign trail. And it looks like some of the polls have tightened a bit. And there's more support heading towards Corbyn. So this is unpredictable. We'll find out tonight when the returns start coming in at 10 o'clock tonight here in London, 5 o'clock time on the East Coast. But I think that conservatives are anxious that they may not have the kind of majority that they hope for, or even what would really, really upset them and put them in a difficult position is if they were back with a hung parliament.
So if Boris Johnson comes out of this election with only a small majority, what is that going to mean for Brexit and the future of the UK?
Well, he may have enough to get his deal through, but one of the things that would be interesting is if it's a small majority, it means he's going to be more reliant on some of the hardcore Brexiteers who might push a very tough deal, sort of a future deal with the European Union, and a much more distant deal economically. That could hurt, you know, the United Kingdom in the aggregate has benefited from being in the EU. If a much harder Brexit, that could damage the economy. And so how Boris Johnson does determine a lot about how Brexit might look and also the future path as basically the United Kingdom starts to chart its own course.
What about from these shores, from America's shores? What is the U.S. interest in what happens today?
You know, it depends on your perspective. If you're talking to President Trump, he wants Boris Johnson to win. He doesn't like the European Union. As we know, he likes to deal with nations one-on-one in trade relationships because he thinks the United States has much more leverage against smaller countries. On the other hand, if you talk to lots of traditionalists, you know, the United Kingdom is a top American ally. Brexit has been, you know, completely, it's been chaotic here politically. And they would like to see the UK move forward, limiting its economic damage, having a closer relationship with Europe, and making sure that Europe is cohesive and intact because of the challenges that the West faces, particularly obviously with Vladimir Putin and a much more assertive Russia, but also farther away, Xi Jinping and his Communist Party in China.
NPR's Frank Lankford in London. Nice to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Happy to do it, Lisa.
You've probably heard of the Freedom Rides, when activists took buses from the north to the south to demonstrate against segregation on public transit. But what about the reverse Freedom Rides?
It was one of the most inhuman things that I have ever seen.
Get the full story on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
This week, U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr criticized the Department of Justice's report on the FBI investigation of Russian interference into Donald Trump's campaign back in 2016. He called the reasons for the investigation flimsy and baseless. Barr's actions over the last few months have been troubling to some, most recently former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, who says Barr is unfit to hold his office. Holder made this scathing rebuke today in a Washington Post op-ed, calling Barr's actions, quote, so nakedly partisan and so deeply inappropriate that Barr sounds more like an unscrupulous criminal defense lawyer than a U.S. attorney general. We wanted to take a deeper look at Barr and his role as the nation's chief prosecutor. And to do that, we're joined by Andrew Rice, contributing editor at New York Magazine. His recent article about Barr is titled Trump's Other Lawyer. Andrew, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So in former Attorney General Eric Holder's op-ed, he seemed to be most bothered by a speech Barr made at a Federalist Society event last month, where Barr made the case for greater presidential power, essentially something called unitary executive theory. You've also written about the significance of that speech at that event. Can you explain what unitary executive theory actually means?
Yeah. So I was actually at that speech, and it was quite a remarkable event. And in that speech, Barr laid out this really incredibly sweeping vision of what presidential power should be. And basically what he says is that the executive powers vested in the executive branch by the Constitution, that the president himself as an individual kind of has illimitable power over those executive branch functions, which is to say, you know, in the most pertinent case that we're talking about here, that it reaches in even to law enforcement, where, you know, the president personally can oversee investigations into his own White House.
Let's talk a little bit more about Barr's beliefs on this. He came back to working in government after nearly 30 years, and you write that he says his objective is to restore order. I'm curious, though, did he embrace this idea of unitary executive theory back when he was attorney general during George H.W. Bush's administration?
Yes. In fact, it's been sort of a lifelong project of Barr's. I mean, one of the points that I tried to make in the article is that while, you know, many people in Washington have seen Barr's emergence as a full-throated partisan defender of the president as kind of coming out of nowhere because he was this, you know, respected former attorney general. He had been attorney general once before. You know, really it was part of, grew out of something that he's been arguing for really his entire career in public life, which is that the president should have more power. He came into Washington in 1973, starting off at the CIA, actually, as an analyst and lawyer there. there. And he really sees the Watergate era reforms coming out of Nixon's abuses of office as a kind of constitutional wrong turn. And so he's really spent his entire career trying to roll them back. And he's not been alone in that, I should mention. You know, other people who talked about this similar sort of vision of executive power include people like Dick Cheney and the advisors surrounding him during the Bush administration. Probably the intellectual godfather of the unitary executive theory is Antonin Scalia. A lot of it grows out of a dissent, actually. He wrote in a somewhat obscure case in the 1980s involving the independent counsel statute.
You brought up Cheney and some of the others, but I'm just curious, and of course President Trump is a supporter of this idea, but there are other groups, checks and balances, which you write about, made up of conservative lawyers and scholars who oppose Trump, says Barr's views are contrary to the Constitution. I'm wondering, is this a popular view among other conservative Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think we need to make a distinguish between the broader Republican Party leadership, which is mainly focused, I think it's fair to say, on winning elections, and this sort of Republican legal establishment that Barr is very much a part of. Within that Republican legal establishment, the smaller group, Barr's views are quite controversial. I mean, checks and balances is a group of people, many of whom served with Barr during the first Bush administration in the Justice Department, and many of them have come out and quite vociferously attacked his view as being, you know, they even use the word, you know, authoritarian or autocratic to describe what he's talking about.
Yeah, what are your thoughts about what Holder said today, the significance of this op-ed and those statements that he's made?
I have actually two thoughts about it. I mean, first thought is that, you know, it is a pretty astounding critique to see a former attorney general write about his successor in such plain terms and to attack him in the way that Holder did. And I have to say that the op-ed did make a bracing case against Barr. One thing that I think has been less noted is that there is a paragraph in there that is sort of addressed directly to John Durham, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut who's conducting the so-called investigation of the investigation. It's a criminal investigation into the origins of the Russia probe during the 2016 campaign. But what is most interesting is that Holder said something like, reputations are fragile, really directed right towards John Durham, with whom he had worked previously, as a whole history of having worked with him and during the Obama administration. I thought that was interesting because I think he's clearly trying to make an appeal to this prosecutor that he knows to kind of hew towards his vision of how the Justice Department should operate.
Let's talk a little bit about the events leading up to the impeachment inquiry and Barr's role. So during that July 25th phone call between Trump and the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, the call that actually launched the impeachment investigation, Trump told Zelensky to work with Barr and with Rudy Giuliani to investigate Joe Biden and his son, Hunter. What did Barr tell you about that? And is he or was he involved in this whole Ukraine thing?
He basically reiterated what the Justice Department said publicly in the immediate aftermath of the release of that call transcript, which is that he had had no contact with Ukraine, that he had never been asked to investigate anything with regard to Joe Biden. That said, I think what is interesting about it is that it shows Donald Trump's frame of mind, which is that he basically, you know, equates Rudy Giuliani and Bill Barr as a kind of team in his mind. You know, he basically mentions them in the same breath. And I think that's a very shocking thing to realize. I mean, maybe it says more about Donald Trump than it says about Bill Barr. I think Bill Barr would reject that characterization that he is acting as Donald Trump's personal attorney in any form or fashion. But the fact that the president of the United States views his attorney general that way and would sort of presume that he could get him involved in the rest of the stuff that he was doing in Ukraine, I think says something.
How much is he involved in the impeachment inquiry and the White House's response? We know that he declined to do a press conference that Trump asked him to hold to announce that Trump hadn't broken any laws, but I'm just curious.
Well, he's been very, 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 very good, I guess, about keeping himself out of the impeachment Ukraine stuff. And when I say good, I mean skillful at it. There was some interesting stuff that happened in the Justice Department prior to the whistleblower complaint coming out. Basically, when the whistleblower complaint came in, caused this huge kerfuffle in the White House, and they tried to figure out what to do with it and if they had to turn it over to Congress. And basically, they asked this office within the Justice Department called the Office of Legal Counsel, which historical note, Bill Barr used to head. That's like kind of where his original kind of experience in the Justice Department comes from, is from this Office of Legal Counsel, which is kind of like the Justice Department's internal law firm. So the Justice Department's internal law firm took a look at this complaint and said, you know what, actually, you don't have to turn it over to Congress, because this is not a valid whistleblower complaint, because this is from a member of the intelligence community, and the president is not a member of the intelligence community. Therefore, he is not covered by the whistleblower statute, which is, of course, a completely self-serving interpretation of that law. Of course, it all eventually did leak out, but the Justice Department's fingerprints were on that. Since that happened, they've been very quiet. They are not involved, and they're trying to stay out of it.
You know, Trump has a track record of turning on people. I'm thinking about former Attorney General Jeff Sessions. What can you tell us, with the few moments we have, about Barr's relationship with Trump right now?
Well, the president's relationships with any of his cabinet members are a mystery to anyone outside of them. So it's hard to know exactly what's going on in the relationship. But if we know one thing about Donald Trump, it's that he's a lifelong consumer of legal services. And Barr has been very effective as a lawyer, maybe not his lawyer, but as a lawyer. He's served the president's interests in a variety of ways. But we also know that, like, the president's appreciation for those sorts of services can, is only as good as his mood in any given day. It will be interesting to see, there's a phenomenon where I think it's fair to say, as members of the administration have become sort of recognized as power players in their own right, oftentimes the president reacts negatively to that. And, he doesn't like anyone stealing his sunshine. So we'll see where it goes with Bill Barr. That dynamic will be an interesting one to watch for sure.
Andrew Rice is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. His article, Trump's Other Lawyer, about Attorney General William Barr, is in the December 9th issue of New York Magazine. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
The giant oil producer Saudi Aramco is now the world's first $2 trillion company. The company went public in an IPO yesterday, and in its second day of trading today, it hit the $2 trillion valuation mark. For more now, let's bring in Robin Farzad, who's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Lisa.
So Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman first announced back in 2016 that he wanted to take Aramco public. Only a tiny portion, we should say, is in the offing. But why sell off any of the company?
I mean, just look how very profitable it is and the infusion that the kingdom can get. The Saudis break even costs for producing oil, and their oil fields are below $10 a barrel. You compare that to more than $40 a barrel for Russia and almost $50 a barrel for Nigeria. And crude oil is now fetching about $60 a barrel. And the Saudis can churn out as many as, 10 to 12 million barrels a day.
But what's interesting is who is buying these shares. As we know from the past 24 hours, who mostly is?
That's right. I mean, this is overwhelmingly still owned by the House of Saud. They floated a sliver to the public. And because there was pushback for divestiture from Western investors, New York and London kind of sniffed at it. But it's going to be interesting to see when and if emerging market funds and ETFs get into this stock, which is now Saudi listed. When you're a $2 trillion valued company representing maybe the planet's biggest player in hydrocarbons, there's just really no way to avoid you.
And you said there was little international interest, this despite the fact that Saudi Arabia had planned and then scrapped some roadshows to New York and London. Why is there so little interest coming, say, from New York?
I mean, this is a big radioactive thing that happened not too long ago, and it was, you know— The killing of Jamal Khashoggi. You think back to
Mohammed, the journalist.
Yes, you think back to Mohammed bin Salman's happy tour of New York not too long ago, and the biggest corporate players of America with this listing specifically in mind. And there was modernization and diversification, but then that assassination all but ended that story. Even so, you still have the kingdom invested in the likes of Uber with institutional backing. So there hasn't been an effective global boycott.
There was, as well, a drone and missile attack on two Saudi oil facilities back in September that shut down about half of Aramco's oil production temporarily. We know that Saudi Arabia, the government, has blamed Iran for the attacks, although UN experts say there's not enough evidence right now. This, though, is undoubtedly an extremely volatile region. So is it a risky situation for Aramco investors?
Well, the price of crude used to be the ultimate bellwether for the health of this kingdom. Now it's going to be megaphoned by this share price. But I think demand has been healthy. And again, this is such a tiny amount of the company was listed in shares.
It's like 1.5%.
Yeah. So I'm actually thinking, if anything, the Saudis might come back to the trough and sell more shares. And if you could look at it in a contrarian way, they could use the windfall on defense.
At the same time, though, this is an IPO for another fossil fuel company at a time when investors are starting to shy away from
sure.
fossil fuels. How much of a future do companies like this, even as large as Aramco is, have?
You hear a lot these days about peak oil, and only peak oil demand now is the fear. And yes, we're looking at a future of electric cars and a glut of natural gas and solar in the interim. Still, if you look at the numbers globally, oil remains king, and the kingdom is still the cheapest, most prolific producer of the stuff. So I think they're going to play this interim very profitably.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Let's listen now to some key moments from today's House Judiciary Committee hearing, where members are debating the proposed articles of impeachment against President Trump. Democrats seek to impeach Trump on two charges, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. But Republicans introduced an amendment to kill the abuse of power charge, prompting Representative David Cicilline, Democrat of Rhode Island, to lay out some of the findings of the impeachment inquiry from the House Intelligence Committee.
The President of the United States hired Rudy Giuliani, his personal lawyer, to go to Ukraine and lead this scheme to smear Vice President Biden. He then began a campaign personally to smear Ambassador Yovanovitch and then ultimately directed that she be fired to clear the way of this anti-corruption champion so that his scheme could be fully implemented. He directed a hold on the military aid to Ukraine, and no one could provide any other explanation unrelated to his scheme to pressure them to interfere in the 2020 election. Then the president, in his own words, on July 25th, gets on the telephone and asks President Zelensky for a favor to begin an investigation of his chief political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. There's a readout of the call in evidence, which is a detail of this conversation. There's direct evidence from Alexander Vindman, Williams, Mr. Morrison, who listened in on and heard the president utter those words right out of his own mouth, pressuring a foreign leader to corrupt our elections. The president then made admissions in public on October 2nd, October 3rd, and October 4th, then invited another foreign power, China, to interfere in the American presidential election. Its chief of staff acknowledged that the president directed him to put this unexplained hold on aid to Ukraine. The president directed the vice president not to attend the inauguration of President Zelensky because he hadn't yet got what he was demanding, a public announcement intended to damage his political opponent. Ambassador Sondland testified that the Ukrainians were told, and I quote, the resumption of U.S. aid would likely not occur until Ukraine provided the public anti-corruption statement that we had been discussing for many weeks. And then he testified that he spoke with President Trump, and while the president claimed there was no quid pro quo, he made it clear that President Zelensky must publicly announce the two investigations that President Trump discussed on July 25th in the call in order for this security assistance to be lifted. That's direct evidence.
Representative Doug Collins of Georgia, the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, called the impeachment process as unfair. He called to dismiss both articles of impeachment, arguing that Democrats have violated the committee's rules.
This is a travesty. Write about it if you want, talk about it if you want, but the American people see it because the American people understand inherently fairness. They understand due process. Why? Because it's what America was based on. It is what America takes pride in. And when we don't have it, nobody can have it. When we don't have fairness in this committee, how can they stand up and say, out of the two weakest articles of impeachment in the history of this country, honestly, with a straight face, look at the American people and say, we did good. No, you didn't. You stained this body. You've taken this committee and made it a rubber stamp. Did any of the majority run to be a rubber stamp to get the majority? I know the minority on this side did not. You know why I know it's why we're become a rubber stamp? Because my chairman said so 20 years ago. He said so 20 years ago when he said, if the committee only accepts what other people give them and do not on their own verify it and thoroughly vet it, then we are nothing but a rubber stamp. Mr. Chairman, you should have run for a chairmanship, I believe, more than to be a rubber stamp for Mr. Schiff and Ms. Pelosi. We already knew this committee was overrun and overtaken because Mr. Schiff and Ms. Pelosi took it from us earlier this year. There's the first embarrassment. And the rest of it has been an embarrassment since. So as we look at this and as we go forward, we'll have plenty of time to show the complete farce of substance. But, Mr. Chairman, what will live from this day is your ruling and the majority's ruling of minority rights are dead in this Congress, and especially this committee. I yield back.
But Representative Ted Deutch, Democrat of Florida, dismissed the process arguments from Collins and other Republicans on the committee.
What I said is that the president was given the opportunity on December 4th to present himself. He was also given the opportunity to present witnesses, and he did not. So let's be careful in the way we suggest that rules are being violated when everything that's being done here is consistent with more than 50 years of interpretation of the rules and the very essence of why the rule was put together in the first place. So it's important. Facts really do matter. And we're not going to allow the minority to misinterpret the rules for their own benefit or to suggest that the history is irrelevant.
In addition to criticizing the process, Republicans also contested Democrats' grounds for impeachment. Representative Steve Chabot, Republican of Ohio, took aim at the abuse of power charge, saying it didn't meet the constitutional definition of high crimes or misdemeanors.
The majority on this committee goes to great lengths to explain why abuse of power is an impeachable offense, specifically mentioning it was one of the charges against both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. What they don't mention is that the House of Representatives has never adopted alleged abuse of power as a charge in a presidential impeachment. Why? Because there's no criminal statute describing what alleged abuse of power actually is. Abuse of power is therefore a vague, ambiguous term open to the interpretation of every individual. Because abuse of power lacks a concise legal definition, there's a higher burden of proof on those pursuing such a charge to show the actions of the president rise to the level of impeachment. I believed that Bill Clinton had abused the power of his office, but we failed to convince our colleagues in the House, and that particular charge was rejected by the full House. In this case, the evidence provided is less convincing. In fact, I'd argue it's non-existent. First, there was no quid pro quo. Second, it's a widely known fact that Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. It's why Congress required the administration to certify that the Ukrainian government had taken steps to clean up corruption before military aid could be provided to the country. President Trump was well aware of that fact and quite skeptical of giving Ukraine foreign aid long before the now famous July 25th phone call. Third, Ukraine actually received the aid after the president was satisfied that Ukraine had taken meaningful steps to address corruption, which again is an obligation required by law. Based on the actual facts of this case, as opposed to the hearsay and innuendo compiled by the Intelligence Committee, it's clear that no abuse of power ever took place. And there certainly isn't enough evidence to support an article of impeachment.
But Democrats kept going back to what Representative Cicilline called the overwhelming evidence of President Trump's abuse of power. Representative Veronica Escobar of Texas made the case for impeachment with an analogy.
I want to break this down in simple terms for the American public because our Republican colleagues are working overtime to try to convince us that we didn't see what we saw with our own eyes and we didn't hear what we heard with our own ears. Let's bring it down to an example that was used during the hearing. If a governor, if a community suffers a natural disaster and the governor of the state has aid that will help that community, but calls the mayor of your community and says, I want you to do me a favor, though, and conditions with giving the aid to the community on the police chief smearing his political opponent, has there been a crime? The answer is yes. And that governor would go to jail. If that governor later releases the aid after he got caught, it doesn't matter. He still committed the crime. Furthermore, if that governor says during the investigation, I'm going to defy the subpoenas, we're going to fight the subpoenas, guess what would happen to that governor? He's committed a crime. He would go to jail. If the governor then tried to cover up his wrongdoing, cover it up so that his people, his constituents, couldn't see his wrongdoing, what would happen to that governor? Did he commit a crime? Yes, he would go to jail. So as wildly as they're trying to convince you that there was no wrongdoing, I want the American public to understand what is going on here. It's clear as day. We've seen it with our own eyes. We've heard it with our own ears. Facts matter. I yield back.
The House Judiciary Committee is expected to approve the articles of impeachment tonight, which could lead to an historic impeachment vote in the full House next week. We'll be following this story.
This week, Time magazine gave its Athlete of the Year award to the U.S. women's soccer team.
For the fourth time, the United States of America are crowned champions of the world. And for the very first time, they've done it on European soil.
The American women won their fourth World Cup in France this past summer, beating the Netherlands in the final. One of the stars of that World Cup winning team has been singled out for a special honor. Sports Illustrated has named Megan Rapinoe as its Sports Person of the Year. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
I thought you were going to call me the Sports Analyst of the Year. I'll take it.
You just did. And I'll reiterate it. The honor for the team seems to be about a lot more, though, than what happened on the pitch. What do you think it's about?
Yes, it's about what they stand for, and it's about how captivating they were and how much they captivated America based not only on their play and their personalities, which were big, but on their message of equal pay, their message of the message to little girls being able to kind of do anything that little boys do, and the fact that they do not back down from opponents on the pitch or off.
So if that is embodied in one person, one would think it would be Megan Rapinoe. Certainly the voters did. What is it about Megan Rapinoe that especially stood out?
Well, you could argue that she's not even the best player on the U.S. women's national team, although she was great and she won the Golden Boot as the best player in the World Cup. But, you know, Alex Morgan is great and Tobin Heath is great. But she's one of the captains of the team. She's the moral center of the team. She has her teammates back. And when they want to make a point beyond just winning in a game, she's the one that they rely on. She's extremely articulate. I think she'd make an excellent politician because she has this habit of not just striking out against enemies, but pulling in some would-be adversaries. She kind of, in her speech in City Hall after the U.S. women's team got the keys to the city, she was there on stage with her contractual adversary, the head of the U.S. Soccer Federation, and she kind of extended an olive branch and said, you know, I believe that you're going to do the right thing. And to me, sitting there in that political setting, it was an example of, politics being done on a public stage by someone you wouldn't expect to be a politician. It was really – I thought it was really effective, actually, tactically.
If she were to become a politician, as you say you think she should, she probably wouldn't get Donald Trump's vote because she said even before the team won the World Cup that she would not visit the White House to be honored by the president. And that, of course, sparked a reaction from President Trump, who said in a tweet that she I can't exactly quote what he said, but she is certainly not the first athlete to spar with him on social media. What do you make of that aspect?
Yeah, she actually said, "We will not effing be going to the White House." And he came back with, "After so much that this country has done for you, you're disrespecting the flag." And a great thing about Rapinoe is, and she has said this, these comments were made before the World Cup. They surfaced. Trump reacted. Rapinoe stood by them. And then afterwards in her tour with the media, I think she was very articulate in saying why not only her, but no one on the team had any interest in going to the White House. But she didn't let it drag her down. I think she used the platform to make points that were in many ways more articulate than the president. And the other thing is, unlike some of the athletes that the president has picked a fight with, Rapinoe's this super patriot. She loves America. She stands for the anthem. She puts her hands on her heart. But she also speaks honestly in saying we're a great country. There's a lot of great things about America. But we're also a country that was founded on slavery. So she is not a cartoon. And the president entangling with her, I don't think, got any mileage out of it. And that's in contrast to some of the fights that the president has picked with, say, football. Players who don't stand for the national anthem.
During the games in France, fans chanted equal pay, equal pay. And the American women sued their bosses for gender discrimination. Could you tell us the status of the complaint that they're not paid as much as U.S. men's soccer?
So right now, legally, they have been certified, the U.S. women's national team have been certified as a class to represent in a class action, and that lawsuit, unless there are negotiations, as there often are, that lawsuit will go forward and be heard in May. The U.S. men's national team is supporting the women in this lawsuit. The head of the U.S. Soccer Federation has statistics which show that they have been given equal pay. If you look at certain specific time frames, maybe starting from 2010 to 2018, the women's national team can come back with some other statistics saying that, well, first of all, we do win the World Cup and the men don't even qualify. So if you're saying we're paid the same, we have been achieving a lot more. But secondly, you know, for X number of wins, we'd be paid 38% less. There's a lot of way to parse the numbers. And I don't think this is necessarily a slam dunk. They have a lot of sentiment on their side. But just as a factual matter, I think that there are a lot of arguments that the U.S. Federation can make about how much they pay, for instance, the women to play in the professional league. They are subsidized by the U.S. Soccer Federation and the men aren't. So there are plausible arguments there. But in terms of sentiment, my gosh, do the U.S. women, I've never heard a term from a labor dispute being chanted around a stadium on an international stage. That is something.
We're going to have Megan Rapinoe on the show tomorrow, by the way. Thank you, Mike Pesca. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.